Today's episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy. Thanks for supporting the Fable and Folly Network. Here's another show we know you'll love.
Night has fallen. The moon is full. And we're inviting you to listen to Canada by Night, a podcast where professional improvisers play Vampire the Masquerade. Detective-turned-vampire Everett Fry accidentally becomes the sheriff of New Haven, an experimental town where they're testing if vampires and humans can coexist. Stuck leading a ragtag group of officers, the Bruja bounty hunter Val, the Gangrel news reporter Evangeline, and the Tremere blood witch Doris, can Everett keep the town running? Or will everyone end up liquidated by the Vampire Council of Canada? Trending on global fiction charts and produced by Dum Dums and Dice, whose podcast Dum Dums and Dragons ranked number 2 of all fiction podcasts in America, listen now to find out why Canada by Night has been downloaded more than 500,000 times. Canada by Night, it's Interview with the Vampire, if it had all the characters from Parks and Rec in it.
The Fable and Folly Network supports creators of exceptional audio stories, including the one you're listening to right now. If you love our shows, we want to hear from you. Complete our listener survey at fableandfolly.com/survey. This will help us learn more about you, what you like, what you'd like to hear more of, and how we can maintain an inclusive, safe atmosphere. As a thank you for your participation, we have extras and behind-the-scenes content from your favorite shows. Fans make the network what it is. Thanks for listening, and we can't wait to hear from you. Find our listener survey at fableandfolly.com/survey today.
Hello, hello. This is Eleanor, executive producer for Unwell, and I am so psyched to have four members of our cast hanging out here in Jeffrey's living room with me tonight to chat about the show and how it comes together and what we do. So we're going to do a quick run around the circle. Tell me your name, your pronouns, and who you play on the show before we jump in.
Joshua K. Harris, he, him. I play Rudy.
Marsha Harmon, she, her. I play Dot.
Mark Soloff, he, him. I play Silas Lodge.
Ellie Maitland, she, her. I'm the waitress.
And back to me, this is Eleanor, executive producer, she, her. Awesome. Thanks, everybody. Okay, so I'm going to ask this question that was inspired by a conversation we were having earlier before we turned all the mics on. I know that for a lot of folks, when you do like dialects, you often have like a phrase or a sentence that you use to as like your entry point into it. So I'm curious if you have a favorite dialect phrase, and we'll share that. And then I have a follow-up question. Let's share your silly, fun dialect phrases.
Well, I'll share mine because it has a double, an extra Unwell tie-in. The phrase is for a, and I'm really not sure, actually. I think this is like an Edinburgh, Scotland accent, which is, I wrote about Hatfield because I live down the road from it. Which is a line that Bilal Dardai said in a play that New Leaf Theatre produced in 2007 called The Permanent Way, which was a docudrama about the privatization of British Rail, which sounds like it would be the most dry, boring thing you've ever seen, but it was one of the most like vibrant and exciting pieces of theatre that I ever got to be a part of. But so he played a character who was a journalist, a writer from Scotland, and that was the opening line of his monologue when that character was introduced. And that sentence has always just come into my mind. Bilal Dardai does a mean Scottish accent.
Will you do it one more time?
I wrote about Hatfield because I live down the road from it.
Very good. That's very fun.
I haven't legit done a dialect. I haven't done an international, something that is non-American English in a very long time. But I do have like some sort of catchphrases or sounds that help me get into voice for various characters. I do a podcast, a comedy podcast of my own. And for a long time, I hosted it as a Dottore character from the Commedia dell'arte tradition. And he's supposed to be like a big, round, pompous, arrogant scholar, like with a Renaissance garb on. And to get into that voice, I always go, Oh, yes, my name is Dottore Balordo. Oh, the podcast is called Blastro Podcast, like a gastropod, but a blastropod. Although, truth be told, I changed it mid-journey to a different podcast where I improvise movies, also a comedy thing, but Dottore is not present in that. And that one's called Muffed Movies, but it's on the Blastro Podcast feed. And the Silas voice is a little bit of my, was it Benedict or the two brains from Our Fair City? Benedict and Balthazar.
Balthazar.
Yes. So when I say the name Balthazar, I'm kind of channeling a Christopher Lee, and I definitely took a bit of that Christopher Lee kind of thing. And so saying Balthazar gets me half the way there, and then I occasionally do a little like Don Knotts. You know, what are you guys? What are you guys on? You're lost in the woods.
I want to shit.
Oh, so
that. Well, this was absolutely going to be my follow up question was like, how do you get into your unwell character? Because because you guys have all talked, you've talked about how we record and then we like go away for a whole year and then you come back. So yeah, no, that was absolute. Mark, you like went right to my follow up, which is like, what's the version of this for your unwell character when you're like sliding back into it?
It's fun. It's fun to do. It's fun to do acting. I heard, so back when I was like a bright-eyed, bushy-tailed young actor, I loved to listen to audio commentaries before the internet. And John DiMaggio, the voice actor from like a million things, including Futurama, he said that to create a voice, he loves to take different like impressions or different elements and combine like three impressions into one voice. And it's no longer identifiable as Don Knotts because he's added Arnold Schwarzenegger and JFK. And he would dissect them. I'm not that good, but I really like that idea to like plug in many sounds to make a voice.
I've definitely heard Dana Carvey uses a very similar recipe when he's building impressions. So it might not necessarily be like an impression of a person won't just be that person. It'll be that person with a couple other elements of other well-known celebrities. So there's that added absurdity that makes it not only just an impression, but someone that he can inhabit for the duration of a sketch.
I think it's true that a lot of voice artists actually just kind of catalog voices as they go through life. I know Hank Azaria often talked about like the comic book guy was just a guy who lived in his dorm when he was in college. He just did that voice because it's like as soon as he read these lines, like, oh, that's that guy. Or his he was doing some dinner theater or something at a time and doing a poor Pacino impression. And basically that was his motivation behind Mo was a poor Pacino. And it kind of came from there. So we just, you know, we catalog things we hear and use them again.
And it's also like the sustainability, I think, is a big thing too. Like this is not related to anything I do with Heart Life, but there was a character with another podcast that I do predominantly sound artwork with. But I kind of shoehorned in more of a presence for the spokesman of their soap opera, Lucky Duck Soap, where it was just supposed to be, you're using soap, you lucky duck, and then a couple of quacks at the end. And there are people out there that do like excellent impressions of ducks. And I'm not necessarily one of them, but what I wanted to do was have like a route that could then be like used as versatilely as possible. So you just start with the two quacks. Quack, quack. And then as things get more absurd through different
iterations of the slogan or the advertising, then the duck can have more of a sentient dialogue with what's going on in its world by being confused. Or affronted. Downright enraged. So just finding something that you can build off of and have more adventures with and more of an organic relationship with and allow it to grow can be a big part of building any character vocally.
I think that's very smart. And that's actually perhaps a mistake I made when I first started playing Rudy, because the audition I did was, it's in the season one episode where Rudy and Abby and Lily are trapped in the basement and there's all the mannequins and they're in the dark. And Rudy talks about, I believe, the theory of story and the importance of story to humanity. And he goes on a long monologue, as he is wont to do. And for whatever reason, my take on it involved, like, once he gets going, he doesn't stop for a breath. And he just, you know, it just builds and builds. And he thinks he's being very inspiring. Now, I get so out of breath doing Rudy. There have been many times where I'll finish a take or I'll still be in the middle of it and Jeffrey will have to ask me to take another go at it and try to connect these two words as part of the same sentence. And so there's not this gaping in the middle of a take. And so that I should have heard your ideas about sustainability when we first went into this.
When Unwell is finished, you can dive right into Gilbert and Sullivan and you'll just be like so prepared for that lung work.
Absolutely.
Ellie, I'm envious of some of the characters that I've seen you play on stage because you did a lot of work with Wildclaw Theater.
Oh, thank you. That's so kind of you.
Well, I'm such a charitable soul.
Wildclaw being a local Chicago theater that specializes in horror.
Yeah, and she played like a embodiment of, I don't know if it was starvation or wasting away.
Oh, I didn't even realize you saw that show. Yeah. I think that must have been Dread, Scott T. Barsotti. Oh, yeah, a colleague of yours.
Too Hottie Barsotti, as we called him in college.
Yeah, yeah, that scans.
Well.
Yeah. And you were in the adaptation that he wrote of
Shadow for Innsmouth.
Innsmouth, yes. And you were like a human transforming into a fish creature.
Like you do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was like, you can't sit next to me on this bus. Like, like, what an awesome part to play.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and they did not want anyone sitting next to them on the bus. They were two shellfish. But yeah, the relationship between voice acting and also physicality is something that's really fun to explore also. And again, makes for a really safe place in the recording studio because you might be contorting yourself into some very absurd positions for the sake of making your voice sound right. And I guess that's probably also another thing that sustainability would lend itself to, because you don't want to be like tying yourself up in knots and be like, oh, I've got a 3-minute monologue in this position in this character now. Oops.
Turn the page. No, I actually, and I don't know if this is quite the same topic, but hearing you talk about that and doing those voices, I am so jealous of both of you and probably a few other performers in the show who get to do these almost completely removed?
Remove them!
Remove them! these characters that are so removed from humanity almost. Mm-hmm. And you get to do such incredibly fun voice work that is totally of your own making. And, you know, coming into the show, I was thinking like, ooh, I hope they'll let me do these little side big voices and little voices and, you know, all this. And like, oh, I got to play a generally speaking real person and just and just have like a character arc and like try to, you know, have relatable emotions. Oh, okay. Well, okay. I've come to terms with that. And I like it quite a lot, but it's really fun watching and listening to Mark, to Ellie, to other people who do these otherworldly sort of voices, or these voices that do not have their roots in the everyday average human experience.
Yeah. So kind of you. Thank you. And also, again, I'm going to shout out to the sound design team because they make everything that we do go to 11 on the regs
for sure.
In a way that's super gratifying and exciting because they're
like really the final extension of the character is like they're like the special effects.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't feel too badly about being one of the like primary human good guys, good people. Because guess what? No one makes loving fan art of Silas Lodge. Oh.
They will now.
Audience, you know what to do.
That's right. Get to work. Yeah.
This better come out before Valentine's Day.
Oh boy. Just like a picturesque, like serene moment of him walking the dogs. Like,
can we
like,
get Zaddy Silas Lodge?
Yeah. So I think the grass is always greener on the other side. When you're a normal human, you're like, oh, if only I were a star monster. And when you're a star monster, it's like, what? I'm only in 4 scenes in this season? Oh, yeah, I guess I am a star monster. Normal humans take precedent.
Well, jealousy is how I express my love for others.
More like guest star monster.
Hey-o.
Featured star monster.
Yikes.
I got to say real quick, when we're talking about Zaddy Silas walking the dogs through the forest, I was doing an audio drama festival a couple of years ago, and I don't remember his name. I'm a bad person, but the actor that played one of the picnic lovers at the end of season one was there and was talking about this project he just got to do a one-off on. He was so excited about it. And I said, oh, I kill you. So it was a really fun way to bond.
Oh, I know about that project. I got to murder you.
Yes, I'm what ate you at the end.
It's the beginning of a good romance. I killed Josh in our first show together.
Aww.
That's true.
Yeah. Ghosts and zombies. I usually shot him, but with a night when the gun didn't go off, I killed him with an axe.
So not for nothing. I did not ask this ahead of time, but I do kind of want to make you tell the story of how you two met because it's so like gothic horror adjacent.
Yes, and if I were to tell the story, Marcia and I met doing a show called Ghosts and Zombies that began rehearsals in summer of 2017. However, cut to Marcia.
We actually met 3 years before that in a staged reading. So that on the first day of rehearsal for Ghosts and Zombies, which was an adaptation of Henrik Ibsen's Ghost, but with zombies, and it's totally, totally supported by the text.
Because syphilis becomes zombies.
Well, and the original Norwegian word that we translate as ghosts is actually like, more accurately translated as like again walkers, like those who walk again. Oh, nice. Anyway, okay, right. It's in there. It's in there. It's amazing. So right. So at the end of that was another good Wild Claw show. So at the end of the first rehearsal, Josh comes up and he's like, "It was really nice to meet you." Like, actually, we've met. Which was like fine. I'm not mad about it. It was 4 years ago.
But we did.
Like, I wasn't even mad about it then.
But we did a staged reading.
So embarrassed.
We did a staged reading that had a performance and it had like 3 rehearsals. And at some point I said to her, but no, I mean, there was this guy in it and this lady and this lady. She goes, and me.
And me.
I kept listing off the people who were totally in it, but kept not naming her.
Yeah.
I have no memory of it.
Digging deeper. I remembered everybody, mm-hmm. but me. I was mm-hmm. also there.
Mm-hmm. But her revenge is that, I mean, she played the central character and my character, who's in the original Ghost, but in this version becomes a zombie at the end, in the big final zombie melee, you know, mm-hmm. she gets to shoot my head off with a revolver. Mm-hmm. And then certain nights it didn't work. So our fight choreographer, Victor Bayona, if anybody knows him, worked out an alternate solution where she used an axe to...
The back side of an axe with my non-dominant hand.
Got shoved right into my skull via my eye. And either way, lots of blood and it hit the audience.
This was an incredibly badass performance.
It's true. I've
seen Marcia, I have seen you in so many plays because we've been friends a long time. Mm-hmm. And I remember recording this one and just being like, this is so much fun to watch. Really and there was so much combat in this show that if you sat in the first row, they gave you a poncho.
Awesome. What movie was this with? This is Aquavit.
Aquavit, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
But the coda to that is that we actually got married during this pandemic last August. And a wedding gift that was given to us was they tracked down the axe. And And they, I think, what did they write on
the
axe?
Like, you know, what fate has joined together and let no one tear asunder, yes, or something. So, and they, our date.
Our, it still needs date, to be mounted on our wall. Yeah. We have it.
So you married an axe murderer.
Oh,
you did. Why?
Whoa, man.
So I want to ask, do you have any favorite experiences working on Unwell?
I'm going to go back to it being about the people and the tradition that y'all have instilled of starting every season with that group read where as many of us are together as possible is always just a really rejuvenating opportunity to connect with everyone and also just share the shocks of everything that's coming out of the story that like all the writers have been working on so hard for months or year or what have you, and just getting to unwrap those presents together and the tradition of just like flopping the hard copy scripts into the center of the room at the end of each scene is also just really fun and feels very family.
That reminds me actually of our very first time all together in our previous space where we met for a full day and read through all of season one. Jeffrey was there, Eleanor was there, all the writers, most if not all of the cast. I don't think we got to have all the designers or anything there necessarily, but we got to be in a room reading all of this together for the first time. And there was exactly what you were saying. There were so many Michael Turrentine reactions to plot developments, and we got to hear people give voice to these words for the first time and like, oh, well, that's what Lily sounds like, and that's what this person sounds like. And I also remember one of our writers had very recently had a little baby, and that baby got passed around that room and parented and loved by that room so that writer could be free to actually listen and do their job.
Yeah, that was miraculous to me because I had been thinking recently on another production I was working on, a stage show where the set designer had a 5-year-old and she would bring him to tech and he was like sleeping on the couch in the hallway. How like for, you know, particularly women, but like working parents in the arts, in especially creative endeavors that are not your full-time job, that like it takes the whole company to make it work. It took like 4 or 5 different people who were not actors in the scene or who were not the people who wrote the scene to be like, oh, sure, I'll walk with your baby into the hallway so that you can listen to this scene and the baby won't bother you and nobody.
And transparently, we prepped that. Yeah. So that was Jessica Wright Buha. Her daughter Molly was an infant at that first read through of that season. And Molly had been in a number of writers' meetings leading up to that. And we would just pass her around. And so going into that full read, I was like, it's really important to just be able to actually like pay attention and work. And so there were a number of people on the team who I reached out to in advance of that to say like, how do you feel about like taking baby duty? And basically there were just like a couple of people that I was like, okay, so this is the thing that's happening. And so like, I need like 3 or 4 people in the room who can just kind of like swoop in and take Molly off Jess's hands if needed. And like, you know, the team stepped up and it makes a big difference.
Yeah.
Well, that says a lot because I mean, from our experience, it was like, look at this room full of.
Right. You're talking about it like it was magic. And I just wanted to share that like, no, we prepped that.
Great. Right. There's no magic in the world.
Magic is people.
It wasn't magic, but it did feel like miraculous. Yeah. It felt like really special. Well,
so a lot of us who just didn't know each other yet and we're just so seamlessly taking care of this child for this person who needed that in the moment. But that also speaks to Eleanor, and I will include Jeffrey, and the way that you both underpin everything with safety and care, and just a lot of forethought for what the experience will be like in the room on the day, that makes it so easy for the rest of us. When we talk about, oh, I'll show up 5 times a year and I'll record something into a mic. Well, that's not the experience for everybody. For the two of you and for our designers, I know that they're, that experience can look very different, enjoyable, I'm sure, but not like that.
And I was articulating to somebody in my life recently that I would define the job of a producer, and I've been a theater producer, I've been a podcast producer. Like I've been an event producer. Like I've done this in a lot of different spaces. And I feel like the thing across all of them is that I think that the job of a producer is to make sure that your team and your audience always feels safe and supported in the thing that they're trying to do. And that is a thing that can be interpreted in a lot of different directions. But like, that's always sort of, I feel like that's for me, the central thing of like, whether or not I feel like I'm doing my job well. It's like, does my team and does my audience feel like they can show up and do the thing and feel safe and supported?
Job successfully done.
Oh, yeah.
Thanks, guys.
There's so much conversation right now about like how problematic at least in the Chicago scene, the theater industry is, especially for folks that are trying to create art around or through full-time jobs. And the calls for accountability and transparency in all of the production practices, those really stem from a need for pragmatism and empathy. Mm. And I think those are two things that y'all consistently bring to the table. And so thank you for that.
And now I'll branch off that and say that while I'm complimenting Eleanor and Jeffrey, I'll also compliment Jeffrey on direction, specifically because we have been so disparate, especially in this last season. And it would have been very easy for all of this to come across very disjointed. But I know that it wasn't, because when you're recording in a room with Jeffrey, Jeffrey lets you play, but also will come back and say, hey, could we get this out of this take? And then I realize like, oh, that's what makes it work with the other person's line or this other scene that's going to happen. And and that's what direction's always been about. But to get to watch it happen in real time and unsuccessfully, it's beautiful.
I would also throw in that like the protocols that the team put in place for us to be able to record safely during COVID pre-vaccines, it was a lot of really simple things. It was a small group of recording. It was, we sat far apart from each other. We were all wearing masks. When we got into the recording studio, our mics were so much farther. Like we were together, but we were so far away, and we had the mics and then like an extra screen. So there were so many, like just the joy of being physically in the same room with someone was great, but then also the safety of not being very close to them. And knowing that, like, if I did, like I think the rehearsal I missed or the recording session I missed, like, I wasn't that sick. It wound up kind of being nothing, but everybody was on the same page of like, we are not taking any chances. This is, nobody's like, I'm not being a problem by saying I don't feel well and I'm not coming in. Nobody's mad about it. Everybody's kind of relieved that it's like not a thing you have to worry about, you know? So that really created a safe space.
And to highlight how important and cool that is, we've all worked many places where that wouldn't go over that way.
Yeah, we got to normalize being able to say no. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'll just say, if any listeners are curious, we took our protocols for recording during the pandemic and we published them publicly. And we can link to these in the show notes for this, assuming we don't cut this bit. Because we did share that stuff and, you know, your mileage may vary. Also, the world has changed a lot since last summer, but not enough. But if anybody is curious, kind of like the ins and outs of how we navigated that, it is available to take a look at more closely. I want to ask, so we've aired 3 seasons. You all have gotten to read season 4. Nobody else has heard it. So if you share any spoilers, I promise we'll bleep them out. If you could ask for something for your character before the show ends, what would you ask for?
I would like for Dot a torrid love affair, real or imagined, with Rusty Standish.
I think we all want that.
Yes!
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
My goodness.
Thank you.
I've always wanted Rudy to get to go to space, but since that's the whole theme of season 4, maybe... No, you know what? Actually, what I genuinely want for Rudy, given the way things have been going, I want Rudy to have one at-length, really friendly, heartfelt conversation with somebody.
Anybody at all?
Does Spencer count?
Well, yeah. Yeah. I guess that's always happening. We just don't get to hear it.
We just don't know Spencer's side.
Oh, hi. I don't know how long it takes for a Grubhub driver's reviews to aggregate so they are no longer eligible. But boy, do I want the waitress to find out.
Two things. When I auditioned for Silas, some direction I got was first take the voice deeper. So I was experimenting with like a real willowy, wispy little guy. And then do that monologue he does in episode one about the woodcutter and transform into a monstrous wolf as you are telling the story. And I was like, yes, please. So I would love if Silas could do some mutation transformation stuff, and that I could also do that with my voice, and it wouldn't only be a sound effect or something. The other thing, I would like to see Silas in his alive form, if that is even the same guy as we know today. I'd like to see who it is that Silas loved in life, because I believe that Silas had a love, and I would like to see him interact with that person or thing. I don't necessarily need to see like the origin story, but I'd like to see what was this thing when it was human. What was Dracula when it was just Vladimir Tepish?
Also, can the Fenwood House get a cat?
We say because there is a cat wandering through our legs quite wonderfully.
A perfect, perfect.
There's a thing early on where Abby suggests that they're paying the cat the pet fee at the house just in case a cat makes its way into their life. And I've always kind of imagined that that might end up being the like postscript to the very last episode. It would be like every other plot point in the entire show has been settled. And then the very last thing, Abby gets a cat.
The credits run and then you hear that the bells of the door opening.
Meow.
Yeah. Yeah.
There is an Abby cat connection, because when Abby's spelunking, they hear the story of the curious cat that got mushed up.
That's
How to make cat bread is what the story should be called. It's a recipe.
When Jim brought that episode to the writers' meeting for the very first time, we all sat down and we all opened the scripts, and Jim went, "I want to apologize before we read this specifically to Eleanor and Jeffrey. Does anybody else own a cat? No, just the two. I'm specifically to Eleanor and Jeffrey." And then we read the episode, and I spent the entire time just like curled up, like my whole body just like reacting to how awful it was. Yeah, I had a lot of feelings about that.
I mean, it's good horror.
Oh, yeah.
Because it made me feel some things.
Yeah.
It's just...
Well, I can't promise that we can work all those desires into future seasons, but I will report back. I will share that with the writing team and see what we can do. Thank you all so much. This was really awesome. It's really rare that, particularly in this last year and a half, to get a bunch of folks together and just like hang out and talk about the work. So this has been a real joy for me, and I'm excited to share all of this with our audience. So thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
The Fable and Folly Network, where fiction producers flourish.
Friends, half-orcs, countrymen, lend me your pointy ears. Of Mice and Men and Monsters is a podcast which combines the art and beauty of classic literature with the fun of Dungeons and Dragons roleplay. These episodes are led by me, Kate, your master teacher, which is Dungeon Master meets High School English teacher. We take on quests in these fascinating worlds, meeting and adventuring with the greatest literary characters of all time, solving puzzles set up by the dubious Dr. Frankenstein.
One eye is over there, and the other eye is rolled over there.
Exactly right.
Hunting Moby Dick alongside Captain Ahab.
I've rolled a one.
Oh, you rolled a one!
Of Mice and Men and Monsters is a faithful yet irreverent way to interact with the stories which have influenced us for centuries. Plus, it's a much more exciting way to experience literature than writing an essay. Essays don't have swords which burst into flame, or poop monsters hiding in toilets.
Anybody got some poop for me?
A new episode of Mice and Men and Monsters is released every other Wednesday, wherever you listen to podcasts.